to engage the scientific community very much?
It's a brilliant question. There's a difference between what nature did and what we're doing. Nature did it at the peer reviewing stage, pre-publication peer review, whereas PLOS One is post-publication peer review. So there may be a difference. Once the paper's out there, we think the community is going to have more of an interest in actually annotating it. But you'll be interested to know that the editor of Nature and the editor of PLOS One were on public radio on the most prestigious radio station in Britain, the Today programme in the morning, everyone listens to it. The editor of Nature bet the editor of PLOS One a bottle of vintage champagne that this commenting feature will be a failure in 1 year. So we've got a year. If we want the champagne, we've got launched? A year. Sorry?
When was it launched?
It was launched end of December. It's only got a few months worth of content. We've got a year to win the champagne. But you're right, it is, to some extent, it's an unknown quantity. And certainly last week was a very important week for us, because three universities did this journal club. And it was fantastic. Spontaneously, we didn't pay them a bottle of champagne to do it. They spontaneously said, we want to do this. So I think there's going to probably, I don't know, I think that what will happen is, as people see the commenting and the value of the commenting, the thing will take off. But it's an experiment, you never know. You should go and find a paper and comment on it. That would be good. In fact, maybe, you know, you could all do a journal club on a paper in PLOS One. I'm not sure how much social sciences stuff there is. At the moment, it's much more oriented towards kind of basic molecular stuff. There's a bit of clinical medicine. There was a paper that I actually commented on. It was a paper on an intervention to reduce the use of the way in which, I can't remember, men in Colorado were using prostitutes, and it was an intervention to reduce the rate of use of prostitution. And so there were lots of things wrong with the paper, I have to say. But firstly, the United Nations has argued that you shouldn't use the word prostitute anymore for a variety of reasons, that it's stigmatizing, it doesn't accurately describe what people do. So I did that little comment, and then actually got into a very interesting discussion with the authors about why they used that word and so on. So there you go. Hopefully you can find a paper for this journal club. Yes?
Can I ask a half-formed question?
Yes! I'll give you a half-baked answer.
Fair enough. So you, of course, present a very compelling case why, if logic were involved, we'd all move towards open access journals, but clearly we have not quite got there yet. So, I guess thinking about the other forces that are at play here,
yeah.
And the vested interest and so forth, how much of it is just kind of fear of these, you know, these kind of traditional journals to switch over to a different model, and kind of being waiting for the early adopters to do it and to kind of pave the way? How much is as being one way, right? These guys can flip over to open access, or you could see the creation of new journals,
yeah.
But who don't have the same sort of cachet. And you know, for academics who are looking for tenure and other kinds of recognition, there's a barrier there.
Right.
So I just wonder. I guess I don't know if you have
a sense
of these kinds of institutional and kind of psychological barriers and how they play out.
They're great questions, and I can certainly attempt to answer the issues that you've raised. Firstly, we're seeing a lot of movement in the rest of the publishing industry. Which is great, but we at PLOS cannot publish every paper. We were a small non-profit. That's never been our intention. We would like to see the whole industry be more socially responsive. And we're seeing exciting movements. For example, Elsevier and Springer. The three big biomedical publishers are Elsevier, Springer, and Taylor & Francis. They own 60% of the world knowledge right now, medical and scientific. Elsevier and Springer now offer an open access option for some of their journals, a fairly small number. It's an experiment. They're going slow. But for some of their journals, if the research funder will cover the costs of creating that PDF, they'll do open access with a Creative Commons Attribution License. Something is happening. I mean, I think PLOS probably played a role, and other open access publishers played a role, and the NIH and the Wellcome. There is movement happening. One of the reasons that movement is happening is self-interest. The Wellcome Trust, the world's largest private biomedical research funder, has now made it a condition of receiving a grant. They're the most radical. A condition of receiving a grant that the final published work is open access. You can't get grant money unless you do this. Elsevier makes a huge amount of its money from publishing Wellcome Trust funded research. So if they don't get their act together, they're going to be in a bit of trouble. So that's one side. Then there's the other side, which is the tenure and promotion. My own gut feeling, and I have no data on this, it's just a gut feeling, is that's probably the biggest obstacle to what we're doing at PLOS, right? In the science world, there is this measure called the impact factor. It's supposed to be a measure of how important and influential your journal is. It's actually a very flawed measure. It doesn't tell you anything about the work of an individual. It's a completely anti-scientific measure. It's a for-profit company, Thomson Scientific, based in Philadelphia. They refuse to make their processes public. They're responsible only to their shareholder. I don't believe in it. However, people make decisions about the value and the worth of an academic based on the journal impact factor, the journals that have published their work. They might get money. I mean, I have a friend who's a researcher in Australia, and he says, every time, I can't do it in Australia now, Gavin, every time I get a paper that's in a journal with impact factor over 7, I get $10,000. You know, literally, people get money when their work appears in journals with high impact factors. Now, if that's what we're up against, the only way we can compete is to have high journal impact factors, right? We at PLOS don't believe in impact factors. Having said that, PLOS Biology happens to have the highest impact factor of any general biology journal, right? PLOS Medicine is in the top 5 or 6 journals. We're only 2 years old. We have the same impact factor as the BMJ, which is 200 years old. So by this anti-scientific, anti-democratic, rather ridiculous, flawed measure, we're doing very well. We've got this bizarre system where we've got this bizarre situation where we've got academics going, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, we can publish with you, we can still get tenure, and we've got this weird mixed feeling about it because we actually think that we as a community have to come up with way better measures than the impact factor of the value of a scientist's work. But it is not harming our case, right? You know, that paper on the world's first circumcision trial, arguably one of the most important, I mean, there were 2 more this year you may have heard about, so there are 3 now, but the very first one came to PLOS Medicine. You know, I don't know what made the researchers do that, but it, you know, this traditional measure is helping. Now, I think what the future requires is for sharing research to be valued in tenure decisions, right? I mean, that's what needs to happen. People need to be valued for publishing in open access journals. When Joe DeRisi, a researcher at UCSF, published his paper in the launch issue of PLOS Biology, the launch issue, I mean, how risky is that? The Chancellor of UCSF went public at the press conference to say, we are so proud of Joe for having done this. And that's what PLOS needs to see more of happening. Because that is, I think, probably the greatest obstacle. You know, we'd love to publish with you, but the New England Journal has an impact factor of 25, that kind of thing. It's very hard to argue. And, you know, no one's going to read the paper in the New England Journal, or not no one, but only those who can afford a subscription. You know. I think there's a generational issue as well. I'm sure there is. I think, particularly if we can demonstrate the value of open access, and that's probably 5 years, something like that. The killer app, I had to learn what a killer app means, but apparently, as soon as we've got a killer app that shows what can happen with open access, the editor-in-chief of Computation Biology is convinced that once we've got a killer app, it's going to be very hard to continue to keep this knowledge locked away. And who knows what that's going to be, but he's working on the case.
Are there any open access universities?
Open access university, I don't know, I mean, there's this, isn't there a lot going on here with courses being...
MIT's
famous...
I mean, universities that require their professors to only publish...
Oh, yes, yes, they don't require you to publish, many. I mean, that's, 2006 was the year of open access in all sorts of ways. One of the reasons was the huge number of universities that said to its scholars, we need you to make your work freely available. Now, they didn't say you need to publish in journal X, Y, and Z, but they said you need to archive your work in an institutional repository and we'll set one up. So there are now mandates. There are now mandates, an increasing number of university mandates, saying if you're a scholar at our university, we want you to put a copy of your work into our institutional repository.
For public viewing or for institutional?
For public viewing. I mean, that's one of the problems with repositories, right? Some repositories aren't public. Only the university researchers can read it. And that sort of defeats the object a bit, really. But these mandates are usually around public access.
So there are universities where every professor, every paper published through the university is open access?
Well, I'm not saying it's happened, but I'm saying that there have been mandates. And I don't know what the rates of compliance are. I mean, some of these mandates are very new. You know, they're a few months old. And then there are questions of, well, how are we going to do it? You know, it takes time to put your paper into your e-print into an archive, and who's going to do that, and all that kind of stuff. So there are those issues still to be sorted out, definitely. You've already asked one question, but I'll come back to you. Yes.
Are there any organizations or institutions working towards creating like an open source algorithm to sort of rival the impact factor, or?
That's a fantastic question. There are people coming up with alternatives. I mean, Google is coming up with an alternative. You know, I gave a talk recently to a group of social scientists, and they said, in our world, we've got all sorts of interesting ways of assessing what people do, and you should come and talk to us. Because, you know, when we publish a paper in PLOS Medicine, the citations we care about, and how many times it's been downloaded we care about, but actually what we care about more is, did something change as a result? You know, did health policy change? Did a foundation give a grant to address this problem raising it? So we need to come up with better ways of monitoring the impact of what we do in that way. It's not very easy to do, but there is a literature on this from the kind of the education world that we need to learn from. And yeah, there are people trying to come up with better measures. You know, the way in which the impact factor works, don't get me started, but the impact factor, if you have a high journal impact factor, it usually means that you've published one or two papers that were very, 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 very highly cited. Most papers aren't. The company that measures impact factors, they don't even have the technology to work out how often an individual paper has been cited. They haven't got that technology. I don't know what they've been doing. And so they can't even tell you the impact of an individual. I mean, that would be a good start, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not great, but it's better than nothing. To find out how often the paper that you published, how often did that get cited? They can't even do that. They don't have the technology. So they have to do this proxy measure of total citations to a journal. There you go. But if you'd like to help to come up with a better tool, if you're interested... No, I'm serious. If this is your expertise, we need to do better at PLOS at coming up with alternatives, and we haven't done that yet. So if you have an interest or expertise or both, please do come and help us.
I have an interest, but no expertise.
Well, that helps. Interest is a good start. Yes?
In broad terms, what do you see as the revenue model for humanities, social science, journals, and my worry is going to end up resulting in an imitation regime, or how it's really set up in many ways. A lot of universities or corporate sponsors paying for journals.
My battery's just died. Technology, that's great. The model that I wanted to show you is a model that John Walensky came up with from the Public Knowledge Project in Canada. They're moving to Stanford, which is exciting because we're in San Francisco and we hope to be working more. And he showed the sums of money involved and how it's possible to transition to open access. The assumptions were the following. One, you abandon print. Print's incredibly expensive, right? Or you do just print on demand. For those that want it, they can buy it. So you abandon print. Secondly, you transition to open source software, which is free. Thirdly, the money that gets saved from never having to subscribe to a journal again, that's a huge amount in medicine and science. It's not as huge in the social sciences, but it's pretty significant still. All that money that gets saved, you put half of it towards covering the costs of open access journals. And you run these as a cooperative, students and faculty and the academic publisher and the university. You cut your overheads by going to this open source software. You save money on, for example, bizarrely, it's not that bizarre, maintaining a list of subscribers is actually very expensive to maintain that list. That disappears. And in Canada, there happens to be a federal program where every Canadian social sciences journal that's peer-reviewed gets around $30,000 in federal money. With all of that, he actually found that the transition would lead to additional revenue. So it's doable. It's absolutely doable.
Do you think you kind of advertising revenue?
I mean, we have advertising revenue in PLOS, right? So we have a mixed business model. I mean, we get... Right, I mean, there are lots of people who hate us for all sorts of reasons, but the people who hate us say, well, you know, you haven't shown immediately that you are sustainable on day one from publication charges. Well, firstly, it takes any new venture. A subscription-based journal takes 5 to 10 years before it breaks even, typically. Subscription-based, 5 to 10 years. So to hold us to this bizarre standard that on day one we have to be sustainable through publication charges seems rather ridiculous. Secondly, they hold us to the standard, you have to be sustainable only from publication charges to show the world that you have this fantastic business model. Again, that's bizarre. I don't know of any journal that doesn't have a mixed model. I used to be one of the editors of the BMJ, the British Medical Journal. We had a mixed model. Some subscriptions, advertising revenue, foundation support, selling value-added materials, kind of knowledge materials that pooled content. So why should we be held to a completely different standard? We happen to have a mixed model. We have foundation support. I don't have a problem with that. I happen to believe that we are a socially oriented non-profit, and if there are foundations that want to support what we do, that's fine. We have advertising. We don't advertise drugs and devices. We've got pretty lefty editors like myself who, when we started PLOS Medicine, said we need to break this ridiculous cycle of dependency on drug companies. What's this bizarre notion that journals can only survive with drug company money? We've got to destroy that. So we're the only medical journal that refuses to advertise drugs and devices, which has limited our revenue, but I think it's given us other benefits. But PLOS Biology's got full of ads and pipettes or something. PCR machines and all of that. So we have a mixed model. We have foundation support, we have advertising, we have publication charges, and we have universities that support us. Universities can become members of PLOS. They don't have to. No one has to do anything. All our journals are free to everyone, forever. But if they want to support us, they can fund us. They get a benefit because the publication charge for that university is lowered. But it's not a subscription. No one has to do it. They do it because they want to support us. So in a mixed model, this is completely viable. We also want to show that it is possible, actually, to be sustainable from publication charges alone. And these three community journals, run by the community, for the community, we deliberately launched those to show that these could break even from publication charges alone. And PLOS One will be revenue generating. Yes?
On that note, the American Chemical Society has recently come up with a so-called author choice
option, yeah.
Which sounds like an author could pay additional funds if they want to make their article open access. But the contingencies that they apply on that are really just an open access green model. So I didn't know if you had a comment on that or if this is a disturbing trend. If somebody's going to pay some money, then open access gold...
Yes, there is a trend, there is a rather bizarre trend. I mean, this sounds like an example of this bizarre trend, which is paying to be allowed to archive your work.
Which you're already entitled to do after 12 months in some cases.
Right, so I'm not sure that you get much value for money. I mean, you might have read that Elsevier last week did a deal with Howard Hughes Medical Institute, one of the largest medical research funders. And the deal, it's a step in the right direction, but again, it's where the authors can pay to archive their work. So I'm not sure it's the most radical.
It sounds to me like, from what it says on the site anyway, that
yes.
Archiving in some other institutional repository,
right.
Something like it would be housed and protected and preserved at that.
Yes. I mean, one thing that we work hard at doing is that we are aware that the language of open access gets appropriated, right? The Lancet, one of the, premier medical journals on the planet, great journal, calls itself an open access journal. It's ridiculous. It's a subscription-based journal. It happens to allow archiving, but not of the corrected version. And so, and the copyright still applies. And if you look at the definition of open access in the Budapest Open Access Initiative, it was very clear. This is not just about free to read, it's about free to use. Right? You need to be able to crawl and data mine and extract and do all the things that the web allows you to do that's going to generate new knowledge. I mean, that, in my view, is what true open access is about. And if we have this technology that's going to find new knowledge, why are we not doing it? You know, and the same technology that allows all this to happen is being used by corporations to, you know, to lock it up, which is a tragedy, one of the great tragedies of our time. Yes.
I think we have time for
one more.
Question, so. Make it a good one.
Make it a good one. The pressure's on.
Okay.
You've got the best facial hair. That's a good start. So.
You mentioned that Duke people were coming to the large view through Westlaw and Lexis.
Yes, and the institutional repository.
And that makes sense to me in part because that's how people tend to find, you know, law articles by searching in Westlaw. There's nothing, for the most part, in most of the humanities areas that I'm familiar with, there isn't something like PubMed.
Right.
Or one of these freely available, you know, I mean, access to being able to do searches for articles have been free in bioscience and you know, biohealth sciences for a while.
Yes.
I mean, you get to the point where you want to see the article and maybe even the abstract and you need the wall.
Yes.
If that doesn't exist, are we supposed to, that's been funded in part because, you know, I mean, PubMed is built by the funding agencies, which are, you know, have a bunch of money.
The NIH, right.
Which is
yes.
very particular to the biosciences. Also,
yes.
Who's going to build the similar system?
So there's
for,
no search engine apart from these law ones.
There's
no social sciences search
engine. I mean, we just,
wow.
Google's working on it.
Yeah.
I mean, do we just hope
yeah.
that Google does it? I mean, yeah. I don't know. That seems kind of like not an answer I'm entirely comfortable with, but maybe it's the best one.
Well, no, I mean, as I said, I don't know anything about...
Seems like it's another missing piece.
Absolutely. I couldn't do my job as a journalist and physician and editor
right.
without this search engine that I use every single day, Medline. Every single
right.
day. I don't know, I really couldn't operate. So it's striking that there isn't something similar in the social sciences.
So there are sometimes similar ones. They're usually owned by people.
I see. They're proprietary. You have to pay.
That's right.
For
the search engines themselves are frequently
right.
proprietary.
Right.
Yes. And so it's just another thing, sort of.
Yeah.
Online.
Yeah.
And so even if we have, you know, convince everyone to release
yeah.
their papers, we still, you know, got.
But then the open access social sciences movement has to work on creating an open source
right.
search engine. Absolutely,
right.
top priority. And you're the one to do it. Thank you very much.